Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're glad you're here. And today we're digging in our vast archives for this hour of today's exchange. Leah Hager-Cohen wrote the book I Don't Know and joined us on the air in August of 2013. Since this is recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Consider the three-letter phrase that gives people in our culture the most anxiety. No, not I love you, but I don't know. How many times have you watched a political debate and watched the contortions of a candidate who clearly did not have an answer to a question, but simply would not utter the human phrase, I don't know? And it's not just politicians. Today's guest points out how often many of us will go to great lengths to avoid uttering the phrase for a variety of reasons. Leah Hager-Cohen wrote a book called I Don't Know, in praise of admitting ignorance, in parentheses, except when you shouldn't. Leah Hager-Cohen is the author of 5 novels, including The Grief of Others and 4 other nonfiction books, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
So what was the starting point here? Did you notice other people didn't say, I don't know, or you didn't?
Yes, well, I noticed it in myself. I've been teaching for the past few years, and I would talk with my students at the beginning of the semester about how important it is to feel free in the classroom to ask questions. And then I began to notice in my own life, lots of times I'd be in conversation with someone who would, that person might make reference to another individual or the title of a book that I hadn't heard of, and out of sort of embarrassment and a reluctance to speak up, I would find myself just nodding in feigned recognition. And so I, when I shared that observation about myself with my students, it certainly triggered a feeling of relief for all of us, and I realized what a difference it made in the classroom, and then I began to be more vigilant myself in social interactions.
Well, the loosening up in the classroom is a key point, though, because, in fact, it seems like it really paved the way for people to be a lot more honest with themselves and get possibly a better learning and experience out of it all.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of energy that many students put into keeping up a front of quote-unquote, getting it, you know, think of how much that energy is taking away from genuine inquisitiveness and genuine engaging with the ideas.
Well, I had to laugh at the image of you in your own learning days looking for a nut graph and thinking it was a visual. What is a nut graph?
Yeah, this was in journalism school, and I heard the word nut, and I just thought, oh, it's going to be a graph shaped like an acorn or something. And it turns out it's journalism slang for that paragraph, usually pretty high up in a news article, that delivers the nut, that is, that gives you the core of what this article is going to be about and why you should be interested in it.
All right, so the central paragraph, essentially, that it kind of lays things out for the rest of the article, but you were looking for something that looked like an acorn.
Yes, and I was completely afraid to raise my hand and say, I don't know what this phrase means. Can you help me out?
So did you finally find that in that class session? Did you have to ask somebody else afterward, or how did you resolve that?
I tried to surreptitiously figure out via my new classmates, sort of what this thing was, and I remained afraid to ask outright, and I just sort of had to get it through osmosis.
There are lots of anecdotes like that in the book, but you actually did a fairly broad amount of research, didn't you?
Yeah, it was so much fun. When I began this project, I had no idea where the research would lead me. And an irony about the book is that I'm not an expert, really, in anything, but researching this book gave me a reason and an excuse to delve into a little bit of, brain science, the neuroscience of the brain and psychology and military strategies and all these different fields that I do not normally find myself reading about.
So there are really two tracks, as you point out, the stuff that we pretend to know and what's the other track there with the...
Yeah, the other track is there's all the stuff that is ultimately unknowable. You know, as mortals, as human beings, we can't hope to know everything about the universe or even about the mysteries of our own psyches and souls. And that's another kind of discomfort I discovered many people share discomfort with the limits of our knowledge.
All right. So, but this brings us back, and you mention a specific example like this in the book too, of the kid we've all known at least once in our lives, who you were telling him things or her things that they possibly couldn't know at age 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever it was, and they kept saying, "I know."
Yes.
And you'd say, "Well, you know, there are actually 4 cycles to an internal combustion engine." And you got a 7-year-old saying, "I know."
Yeah. This was a friend of mine who's a psychologist was talking about her grandson, and exactly as you describe, he was so resistant to being told things that he didn't already know. He had this just automatic response of declaring "I know" to whatever she would try to offer him, and this psychologist rooted his behavior in how sensitive he was to his lack of power in relation to adults. And so for him, saying "I know," even when he patently, you know, couldn't have known, it was this almost instinctive way of resisting powerlessness.
So it was a fear, and as you point out in the book, too, there's really 2 kinds of fear tied up with "I don't know." And what are those?
So as I understand it, one fear has to do with losing social connection, you know, and that's the fear that I tell my students about when I'm sort of outing myself in front of the class. Yeah, sometimes I find myself standing there smiling in feigned recognition instead of speaking up and saying, I don't know what you're talking about. And that's because I'm afraid of shame or embarrassment or being thought little of by the person I'm with. But then the other kind of fear is this more primal or existential fear, which is just the fear of I'm a vulnerable, limited, you know, finite being in this vast universe, and it's scary to reckon with all I don't know.
Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're back in the vault today, getting out a program from our archives. Leah Hager-Cohen joined us in August of 2013 to talk about her book, I Don't Know, in praise of admitting ignorance and doubt, except when you shouldn't. Since the program is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today, but thanks again for listening. So we were talking about the 2 kinds of pretending on the count of I don't know, 2 kinds of fear about why we say that, and then 2 kinds of hope, as you point out as well. What are the 2 kinds of hope, Leah?
Well, one has to do with social connections, right? So if we go ahead and say, I don't know what you're talking about, even though that initially feels scary and like we might then be sort of ostracized or looked down upon for that admission, ultimately, that's what opens us up to having greater intimacy with others. Often, I find it leads to a kind of relaxation in the other person who might have been also putting up a kind of front or been afraid of losing face.
Oh, so you get to those moments of, you don't know either? Really?
Right. I mean, it just paves the way for a truer and closer social connection, allowing ourselves that kind of vulnerability. And then the other kind of hope is sort of just before the break, we were talking about how it can be scary to reckon with all that we don't know in the universe and the loss of control implied, because it's scary not to be in control. But when we sort of allow ourselves to accept the fact that there's a lot that does remain ultimately mysterious to us, it's a kind of settling into oneself that can allow for a fuller experience of living.
With being okay, then, with not knowing something and being interested enough to find out.
Yes.
The Harvard cheating scandal you bring up in here, remind us what the circumstances there and how that's relevant to I don't know-ism.
Yeah, so this broke in the news actually just 1 year ago. About 125 Harvard University students were found to have cheated on a take-home exam. And it was a big news story in part because of the scale of the incident, how many students were involved, but also I think in part because it happened at Harvard, and Harvard's reputation caused many people to be surprised that students who had already been admitted to, you know, this elite, prestigious institution would feel the kind of insecurity that would lead them to cheat, to fake knowledge that they didn't own.
And so this is obviously a huge fear that people are covering by not admitting they don't know. It's hard, though, to fathom that we would ever get to that point where we are just so afraid of letting on. It's okay. People tell us all the time, hey, it's okay if you don't know. Just tell me you don't know and we'll deal with that.
Exactly. And how many times have we all heard, maybe we've heard a teacher say there's no such thing as a stupid question. You know, we've heard that reassurance. But on the other hand, we've also experienced instances in which we went ahead and revealed our ignorance and there were repercussions. You know, whether it's getting passed over for a job or getting a bad grade or feeling... mocked by peers for letting on that you didn't know or understand something. So I think as much as we all pay lip service to saying, don't be afraid to say what you don't know, go ahead and ask, unfortunately, too many of us have had real life experience that reinforces our fear of coming forward that way.
Does it tend to get, I don't know how much this showed up in your research, is it worse, for example, in the workplace where your job is relying upon you knowing things, or worse in academia where you just get bad grades because if you don't know something?
I did find, in my anecdotal reporting, talking with dozens of people who work in various walks of life, certain professional fields do seem to... foster more of this fear and shame around revealing what you don't know. So a number of people who work in the finance industry shared, you know, just cringeworthy stories of being shamed. A lot of high testosterone environments, you know, Wall Street and certain high power, you know, corporate law firms where there's just such a premium on displaying an air of knowledge all the time, whether or not you actually can back it up.
It's basically the I got that covered chief response to the boss.
Right. It's like that's the right response, and you better not have a different response. Interestingly, in medicine, this is shifting. So, many of us are familiar, whether from TV shows or experience or stories that we've heard, with the way medical students are often, it's almost like a hazing ritual when they're on rounds in the hospital, you know, being asked questions and sort of sweating it out if they can't come up with the right answer in front of their peers and the supervising physician. But in medical schools, it seems a lot of thought is now going into, and not just medical schools, but also the medical profession, how to make it more possible and therefore carrying less liability for physicians to be more honest about saying, I don't know, or we need to consult someone else, or even to say, I made a mistake here, and to own up to these things.
It seems like that's why there have been things like checklists developed in medicine in recent years, for surgical procedures in particular, and doing things like take this leg, not the other one, because there was a certain level of pride there where nobody would come into an operating room and say, which leg is it again?
That's right, and I think you're absolutely right when you locate some of this feeling in pride. I mean, I guess an avoidance of shame is linked to a feeling that, you know, you can't do anything to damage your pride.
Ashley Montague is a name you mentioned in here, and his term psychosclerosis. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, so this was a term he used to talk about the hardening of the mind. He was an anthropologist, and he wrote a book called Growing Young, in which he talked about the developments of children into adults. And as he describes it, children are naturally willing to experiment, willing to fail, willing to be honest, you know, not feeling as much social pressure as adults might feel to fake it and to seem all-knowing. But as he describes it in his book, by the time, late adolescence into early adulthood, also the time that for many people traditional education is coming to an end, there becomes a lack of willingness to learn new things, a lack of willingness to entertain doubts, a lack of willingness to let other people see you uncertain. And so psychosclerosis that he identifies with emerging at around this time is the hardening of the mind.
Seems sort of sad that it's the end of curiosity, or at least really out in the world curiosity. It's the opposite of the point in your childhood when you say why all the time.
Exactly. And when you're willing to play and to make believe, and I think the same kind of looseness that we associate with little children asking why and being willing to make believe and entertain all sorts of notions. That looseness, that openness is something that we can retain into adulthood and cultivate as adults. But I think you're right. It's harder. It may be something we have to discipline ourselves, sort of a paradox, discipline ourselves to remain open and vulnerable and flexible.
In other words, plan our spontaneity, in a sense.
Right.
Our openness. Leah Hager-Cohen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about the phrase we really hate to say is called I Don't Know, in praise of admitting ignorance, except when you shouldn't.
You will notice that we do take some phone calls and emails over the course of the program, but they're from the original airing of the program. It is several months old. And so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today, but thank you for listening.
You talked about your own experience teaching your students and letting them know it's okay to say, I don't know. But in general, do teachers, in your experience and research, encourage or discourage the saying of I don't know?
Well, as we all know, because we've been hearing so much about it in the media, this year's high school graduating class will actually be the first generation to have grown up entirely under the No Children Left Behind Act. And so this past generation, there's been particular emphasis on not so much the process of inquiry as on the displaying of the ability of being able to get the right answer. Now, I'm not saying this is true in every classroom and with every teacher. I'm talking about the way federal educational policy has influenced what's going on in education. And there are also many voices, many more knowledgeable and intelligent and experienced than mine, who are talking about this as a problem and how we really need to shift education back to, at the very least, being inclusive of valuing the process of inquiry, which also involves the willingness to experiment and sometimes fail, and that has to be okay.
There's a particular story that stays with me long after reading the book, which is about something your parents experienced with a college professor who had a particular attitude about relaying information to students who didn't know it already. Would you relate that story?
Yeah. This is a story that we grew up on, that my brother and sister and I grew up on in our family, about the college professor who was so irritated with her class for not knowing a particular scholar that she thought they should have been familiar with, that when it was clear that nobody in the classroom knew who he was, she snapped at them, "Well, if you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you." And even as little kids, you know, we got the absurdity of that statement, and it became this, it was a family joke. But how, that's the antithesis, right, of saying there's no such thing as a dumb question and don't be afraid to ask. It's that, you know, not only will I shame you for not knowing, but I will punish you for not knowing by withholding the information from you.
By making sure you continue to not know.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, so a little analysis here. Where do you suppose that idea came from? How could any person who, and she was a professor of language development, I understand, how could she think that way?
You wonder how much she might have come up through such a system, where maybe she had it tough from her mentors and professors, perhaps. It is really disturbing to think of someone in education, of all fields, shutting the doors to inquiry and a safe environment where you can ask questions, including the question, you know, can you repeat what you just explained? I didn't get it the first time. I mean, we have to be able not just to say, I don't know because I'm not already familiar with it, but also, I don't know because I'm having trouble grasping this. You know, teach me again, teach me differently. We as teachers need to be that flexible and be able to teach it in multiple ways.
Oh, sure. So the student needs to be able to say, hey, I think I get it, but do you mean X? And then, you know, get a response from the teacher instead of, well, if you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you.
Exactly.
Let's take a call. We have Mike in Cottage Grove on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Hager-Cohen. Her book is I Don't Know.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was thinking about... knowledge is being power, but there's also sort of, there's things we know about. We don't know things. I'm speaking specifically about history. I know a lot about history, but I wasn't there. I mean, there's people I discuss things with sometimes, you know, and they'll say something like, well, you know, the Civil War was not about slavery. I think it was, or maybe it wasn't. And, you know, we can discuss all sorts of things, you know, the convening of the Confederacy in South Carolina and the use of the word slavery. But there's also, I think sometimes there's a willful desire to be ignorant where people say, well, that stuff is irrelevant. It doesn't matter, you know, because they don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, well, that's irrelevant knowledge, and you don't need to know anything about it.
So it's not just that I don't know, but I don't need to know.
Right. I don't need to know, and I don't want to know. I mean, it's not important.
Yes, and
I might think it is important, and I don't know, but I know about. You know, I mean, I think there's also there's a distinction between actually knowing something and knowing about something. I know a lot about history, but I wasn't there in the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
So I only know about it.
Well, it's a fine distinction, yeah. I know that what I've heard or know what I've read, but I don't know it for sure because I wasn't there. Interesting.
Right,
thanks.
And there's all sorts of sources that you can draw knowledge from or know about vicariously. We can understand a lot about something, but we don't actually know. And there seems to be sort of, to me, there's like a whole universe there that we can only know about. We can't, you know, we can't know the whole thing without having an experience there.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate that. Leah, thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of really good points that Mike made in that call. One is he's making a distinction between knowledge pearls or facts and deep empirical understanding. And that's great. It's a really important kind of humility or humbleness for us to have, that there is a difference between, you know, this little pile of facts that we can amass before us, but then how do we use those to help lead us to a deeper kind of knowledge or knowing? And then the other point Mike made, I'm really glad that he brought it up, because as you mentioned, Jeffrey, the subtitle of the book is In Praise of Admitting Ignorance, Except When You Shouldn't. And so, right, there are instances when we might choose ignorance as a way of avoiding being responsible. Once we know something, that might lead us to feel responsible for doing something about it. And so I'm certainly not advocating the kind of willful ignorance that just gets us off the hook.
You know, you bring up the story of the Emperor's New Clothes in the book as well, which brings up the point that the lack of people saying, I don't know, can lead to groupthink, it would appear, where because nobody says, now, wait a minute, are you sure? That you end up a situation with the Emperor's New Clothes where he ends up walking around naked because they're juking him into thinking he's got clothing on.
Right. And all the townspeople and all the members of the court who serve the emperor, every one of them is so afraid to confess, you know, in this case, not being able to see that not being able to see these supposed garments that he's wearing, that the group think becomes a group lie. And it's a group lie emanating from fear of looking dumb.
Leah Hager-Cohen on the Jefferson Exchange from August of 2013, talking about her book, I Don't Know, In Praise of Admitting Ignorance, Except When You Shouldn't. Since this is an archived show, we can't take new phone calls or emails today, but we can enjoy this anyway, and back with the discussion with Leah Hager-Cohen on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is recorded. She's actually Leah Hager-Cohen from August of 2013, talking about some of the three most difficult words to say in the English language. I don't know. Her book, in fact, is called I Don't Know. We'll return to the discussion in a moment with a reminder that because this is a pre-broadcast program, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. But back to Leah. Second chapter of the book, Leah, obviously about making decisions, and important to admit that at some points you need more information to be able to make decisions. So the question then is, then how or when do you know when you have enough information to make a decision?
Yeah, this was interesting to me in particular with the story of these para jumpers that I researched for the book. And so Sebastian Younger, in his story, A Perfect Storm, in his book, A Perfect Storm, he writes in great detail about this incident where these para-jumpers are jumping out of a helicopter in a, you know, raging storm out over the Atlantic Ocean. And the ocean waves there are swells and then troughs that are hundreds of feet apart in distance. And so these para-jumpers need to time their jump for the smallest possible distance between their bodies and the ocean. They know that if they jump at a moment when the ocean is too far below them, they'll die on impact. And they're incredibly highly trained. It's almost unimaginable the kind of training these para-jumpers have gone through. And the point of that story is, even with all this training, all this expertise, all this knowledge, they can't know. It's one of these instances where they kind of have to just use all their training to make the best decision they possibly can and then jump, knowing that it's largely going to be a matter of chance whether or not they survive the jump. And so I use that story as, you know, I sort of then draw analogies to less high-stakes incidents that we might all encounter in our lives when we have to make a decision and we don't know the right decision.
And so you just hope it comes out for the best based on your training, your instincts, and all those things combined.
Exactly, exactly. And that's, you know, in my research, what I found was that the best decision-making models incorporate instinct and training. And instinct is largely a matter of, almost at a subconscious level, processing past experiences, which is kind of like training, right? It's kind of like it's our empirical knowledge and making use of that to let our sort of hearts and minds guide us.
Or like Branch Rickey said, luck is the residue of design. When you've done all the work, then the decision-making should get a lot easier because your feelings about a situation will be reflected by all that training behind you.
That's lovely.
Let us take some calls. Here is Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Hager-Cohen. Her book is I Don't Know.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment in that I'm the son of a college professor, so I've lived my whole long life with sort of a frustration about how academic people don't like to admit ignorance about things. And I think what I believe is that people have to learn how to live with mystery, that's very essential, and that when you reach a point of claiming to be expert about something, you know, like if you're getting a doctorate, for instance, that you should be able to describe your knowledge in context of what you don't know. You should be able to describe that we know this and this and this and this, but we don't know that and that and that and that. That sort of the limits of things. I have a daughter who graduated from Honors College, and I can remember just talking to her at length that the measure of someone who's learned, who has been enlightened, is to have the ability to say I don't know. That should be the measure of intellectual accomplishment, not the disgrace of it. So,
interesting paradox there. Thanks for the call, Steve. Appreciate that, Leah.
That's lovely. Something I really like about what Steve just said is it's sort of a response to Ashley Montague's description of psychosclerosis. If the measure of how much we've learned is being able to say, and here's what we don't know, it suggests a direction for moving forward with inquiry instead of the sort of calcification of, you know, this is what we know and, you know, that's that, end of sentence.
Let's take another call. Here's Bob and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Hager-Cohen, the author of I Don't Know.
Yeah, I want to address the issue where she was talking about a teacher, I guess, that said, I'm certainly not going to tell you.
Oh, right.
As a teacher, I find that, or have found that it's more important to help the student find answers rather than have the teacher give them answers. So this was an opportunity for the teacher to help the student look into different avenues to find the answer rather than just stand there and give the answer. I think it's easy, it's cheap to just give the answer, but have the student discover that there are other means than that particular teacher to find answers.
All right, Bob, appreciate that. Leah, so was the issue with what the professor said, if you don't know, I'm certainly not going to tell you, or how she said it? Because she certainly could have said, well, grab the book and find out.
Exactly, yeah. If she had said, okay, you guys, you know, go home this weekend and come back on Monday and you tell me who this is, that might have awakened the student's sense of excitement around discovery. I think it was so clear, and maybe I didn't make it clear in my telling today, but I think it was so clear in the story that she was shaming them and really foreclosing on their desire to be open to learning.
And here is Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Leah Hager-Cohen.
Yeah, thanks. An image comes to mind of knowledge is like the air inside of a balloon. And the more of it you have in there, the bigger the surface of the outside of the balloon is, and that's the ignorance that we don't know. I've never been ashamed of ignorance, and I've never felt as though people should be ashamed of ignorance. There's a lot of things we don't know. A fellow once said to me, I could write a bigger book about what I don't know than what I do. But willful ignorance is another thing. And when people start out a comment, when you're trying to say something to them, and you say, well, you can't tell me that. Well, then I figure you're right. I can't. Then I'd like to add one more thing, and that's an existential unknowing that we all live with. And I think it's kind of a part of the human condition that no matter how well we're known by other people, our wife or close people or whatever, they don't know us entirely. In a way, we're private and alone inside of ourselves.
Yeah, and because we don't have telepathy yet.
Pardon?
No. We don't have telepathy, right.
No, they don't. And while we're there, it's also true that we don't know how we're being perceived on the outside world. Even when I look in a mirror, it's left and right is reversed. And so I have no idea how I look or how other people are regarding me. So I think there's kind of a built-in unknowing just in our relations, human relations.
All right. Thanks for that, Brad. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm just smiling right now because I think in a culture where we feel safe knowing some of what Brad just said is you know scary and mind blowing, right? And he evokes the sense of loneliness that comes with the understanding that we might never fully know one another or even fully know ourselves. But in a culture where that stuff gets talked about and acknowledged as yeah, that's part of being here. That's how it is to live on Earth, it becomes a warmer, less foreboding thought if it just becomes a part of the acknowledged truth.
This seems like the time and the place to talk about in the book what you convey that Blaise Pascal said about knowing God or not knowing God.
Right. So so Pascal's wager is. He takes on the question of, you know, can we ever know whether God exists? And ultimately he decides, you know, well, we can't know for sure because God is so immense. You know, God is unknowable to us. We'll never know for sure if God exists. Therefore, it would be safest to go ahead and act as though God exists, because if God does exist, you know, you've got your bases covered, and if God doesn't, you know, no harm done, which I realize is, you know, to people who have a strong sense of religious faith, that might sound pretty, you know, sort of blasphemous. But I think what's interesting to me about Pascal's wager is the way it shows how long humans have been reckoning with this problem of all that remains unknowable. And it does cause a lot of angst, a lot of dread. But the more we talk about it and acknowledge it, and as one of the callers said, the more we embrace the fact that there's a lot of mystery in life, the more we can relax into just being.
Well, when you get right down to it, it really is the basis for both science and religion, isn't it? Being able to say, hey, you know, I don't know this and I want to. And now I'm going to search for the answers.
Yes, that might be the, you know, the very best meeting place for those two spheres.
And in fact, it would seem that not saying I don't know actually blocks the access to information, because if you do say I don't know, then you're at least willing to go look for it or have somebody help you find it.
Right. It's like the little boy who couldn't stand to be told anything that he didn't already know. His knee-jerk response of just cutting the other person off, saying, I know, that is a blocking of information. And frankly, in faith, in religion too, embracing what is unknowable might bring us closer to the most luminous aspects of faith.
We're not mounting a recruitment drive for agnostics, I want to point out, but the fact is we can see where I don't know gets you a little further.
Right, and I guess when I say faith, I don't necessarily mean faith in the idea of God, but faith in whatever it is that makes life so important to us.
Let's take another call. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is I Don't Know, the author Leah Hager-Cohen.
That's a little subject that I've always played around with. When in our life, when in history, Copernicus, Galileo, did they have the courage to step into studying the, quote, unknowable? And the ultimate question, I guess, has probably been around forever. Why is there something rather than nothing?
All right.
And I just wonder, in schools these days, do they allow young people to explore something as fundamental as that without you know, being bound and drugged back because it touches on religion and such.
All right. Thanks for the question, Jim.
I'm just struck by the caller's use of the word courage, and I think that's absolutely right. Anytime we take a step into what's mysterious, what's not already known, that does require an act of courage.
In fact, there's a phrase in the book, telling the truth should never be an act of courage. Who said that? And you get somewhat mixed feelings about that, I gather.
That's right. One of the people I interviewed for the book really impressed me with her poise, her self-possession. She's a very accomplished woman who consults globally, and she said that she's never been afraid to say, I don't know, and that telling the truth should never require, should never be an act of courage. And I thought, on the one hand, how wonderful, how much I admired her for living her life that way. But that quote led me to investigate whether we all can come by courage with the same degree of access. And it seems that those of us who have more privilege, whether it's the privilege of our color or ethnicity or our socioeconomic class or our level of access to education or political power, those of us who have more privilege might be able to risk saying, I don't know, with fewer consequences. And those who are more disenfranchised often, and many of the stories in the book bear this out, often have had to suffer real consequences for being willing to be vulnerable and say, I don't know.
Which, and we've been kind of tickling around the Donald Rumsfeld zone here, the unknown unknowns, the things we don't know, which raises obvious questions about how to approach situations in which we need more info, but we don't know that we do, which then gets to this question, is it even harder than saying, I don't know, to say, you need to tell me, I don't know?
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. The trickiest part of this all is being able to do work in those areas where we don't even know we don't know. And I think that's why it's important to adopt the practice of questioning ourselves and being alert to what we don't know, and introducing into our conversations with others a willingness, spoken and unspoken, a willingness to have the other point out, you're not getting this. And then we can say, okay, let me listen to you.
There's a lot to think about in this book. It's not that big a book and not that long a read, but a lot of provocation to our thoughts in here. The book is called I Don't Know and Praise of Admitting Ignorance, Except When You Shouldn't. Leah Hager-Cohen wrote it and joined us here in The Exchange today. Leah, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.